Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for December 3rd, 2023. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right, good to have y'all on the show. Tonight, in about 20 minutes, we're going to have Doug Kaplan of Kaplan Strategies. Doug's been a guest on our show before, but this is, I believe, the first time Doug will be a guest being the head of his own firm. So we're looking forward to talking about polling with Doug. But until then, we've got a myriad of things to talk about. I guess if you start off later in the week, there were two more political passings. The first female Supreme Court in American history, Sandra Day O'Connor, passed away, as well as National Security Advisor through, I guess, two or three presidential administrations, Henry Kissinger, passed away. Catherine, any thoughts on either one of their lives?
Well, you know, I think it's kind of marks a moment, an end of an era, when the first woman Supreme Court justice passes. You know, I mean, it's kind of surprising that that all happened in our lifetime, right? But I think it's just good to recognize the short time in which we've had women representing us on the Supreme Court. So I admired her. Though I didn't always agree with her rulings, I did admire her service and commentary from time to time. I won't say anything about Henry Kissinger. Thank you.
Yes, and Tim, same question about both of these figures.
Well, I think Catherine pretty well said it all for Sandra Day O'Connor. She was a historical trendsetter as the first woman on the Supreme Court. Ronald Reagan had famously promised he was going to put a woman on the Supreme Court, and he certainly did. And I think he chose about the right person, and she had a distinguished career. Like Catherine, she made some decisions that I wouldn't have agreed with, but all in all, I'd have to say that she was an honorable figure, and she served her country well. As for Henry Kissinger, you know, there he has his detractors, he has his admirers. I mean, there's a guy that spent his whole life basically at Harvard until about 1970, 71, and he's plucked out of there by Richard Nixon, who he got along with very, very well. I mean, they called him Mr. Inside, Mr. Outside. Of course, Nixon was Mr. Inside. Kissinger was the more bubbly guy that would go on TV and present a pretty face for the administration and one that seemed to articulate things well. And thank goodness it wasn't Nixon out there doing that. But they developed detente, you know, with Russia, and they opened China up. He won the Nobel Prize for helping to negotiate the Paris Treaty to end the war in Vietnam. Of course, came out later that he was probably involved in helping to keep the war going through secret negotiations with North Korea, or North Vietnam, rather, to not give the Democrats an issue in the 1968 presidential election. He was all about secrecy a lot. He stayed on first as National Security Advisor and then as Secretary of State through Gerald Ford and left government service in 1977, and I've got his book up here, White House Years, and it's he describes himself as a statesman, by the way, if y'all are interested in the book. He never was a shy fella, but that's the life of Henry Kissinger, and you know, he'll be in all the history books and stuff, and there we are.
Yes, I mean, I have a feeling that Sandra Day O'Connor will stay in the history books more prominently, just given her groundbreaking, you know, achievement.
Yeah.
of course, yeah, definitely. So, but she—I don't know that she was ever in a Marvel comic, unlike I found out that Henry Kissinger was this week. Although it wasn't a very probably positive portrayal in that comic.
Yeah.
Well, let's keep on moving to other things. And apparently, we have had five congressional representatives booted out of Congress by their colleagues. Found out today the story on all that. Three were basically committed treason against the country during the Civil War, and the other two were convicted felons. George Santos is probably on his way to joining them as a convicted felon, but he was also booted out. I don't want to say it all before y'all get a chance to say some things, but Catherine, what were your thoughts on the House's actions this past week with George Santos?
Well, I mean, who's surprised by it, right? I mean, I don't think anybody was surprised to see him expelled. You know, I'm represented by Congresswoman Nikema Williams, who voted against the expulsion, and she got a lot of grief about it. Well, not a lot, but some grief about it online, social media. But I have to respect her comments about it. She said he doesn't deserve to serve in Congress. He's probably going to be a convicted felon, you know, all this, but that he has not been convicted yet, and she's always sides with the voters, and the voters elected him. So I understand that argument. I admire her courage in voting that way. So I'm not sure I would have been able to make that decision, but I hope that I would have, because I think it was the right decision. But we'll see what happens when he goes to court.
Yeah, before I go to Tim, coincidentally, I just was in a room with Congresswoman Williams and heard her talk about that very vote. And I understand her reasoning, but I will say that one thing that makes it a bit different is I actually saw where he took his House colleague's credit card numbers and the parent of one of his House colleague's credit card numbers and defrauded them for donations that they never approved to. And in a workplace, you got to think about it. If somebody in a workplace is stealing from somebody else, even before the rule of law can, you know, the justice system can take effect, you've got to get that person removed from the workplace. And so I do think that kind of, you know, complicated matters as far as the was convicted, was not convicted piece of this. Tim, what are your thoughts on George Santos getting booted from the House?
Yeah, and one of those congressmen who was defrauded got up and spoke very passionately. It was a Republican. Spoke very passionately for his removal because he had money taken. He said, you know, I'm a victim. You know, there had been two previous attempts to do this, and the Republicans turned it away each time. But what happened this time was the report by the Ethics Committee came out, and it was very damning, so damning, as a matter of fact, that one of the members of the Ethics Committee actually came forward to propose this resolution for removal. And after that, the snowballs, you know, started rolling down here. There was really no drama in this vote. It was 311 to 114 with two abstentions. Two Democrats voted no. We know one of them is Nikema Williams, and the other one's Bobby Scott from Virginia. Al Green from Texas and Jonathan Jackson from Illinois, they voted present, and they all said the same thing, basically, that the voters should take care of this, and we shouldn't jump the gun, and la-di-da-di-da. You've done mention he's the sixth member to be expelled, the first one not already convicted of something. But there were 105 Republicans voted to expel, 112 against. And, David, something that you mentioned the other day that is very interesting, all of the House Republican leadership voted against expulsion and basically half their members ignored them. That does not speak highly of the speaker, who did not look happy to be at the podium when this vote was being conducted. But Sanos is out now, and there's a lot of Republican Congress critters from New York who are breathing a sigh of relief because they led the charge to get rid of him because they were afraid that he would hurt them in their districts, and they wanted this issue off the table. Question now is, Sanos says he knows a lot of stuff on a lot of people. What's he going to do with it? So we'll see.
Yeah, speaking of this, I had this shared one this past week. He said that his husband likes to fly fish in North Georgia. So he alluded that he may move to North Georgia, which I got the idea was the Northeast Georgia district, not the Northwest Georgia
district. Please,
Tim,
please not
you
up
and I
won't
here. Go to fly
please not up
him.
Here. Please,
yeah.
Please not up here. I might shoot myself. Or something. Please not up here. We already got Marjorie Taylor Greene, who, by the way, also voted against his expulsion.
Oh, most definitely. She loves drama. Well, and now there's going to be a special election called. And there was already a candidate preparing to run for that seat, you know, theoretically against him. So there's somebody with an infrastructure put in place that looks like I want to say his name's Tom DeNuzzi. Looks like a pretty strong candidate. Catherine, given Democrats' record special elections, that's a pretty good pickup opportunity, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Excellent.
Yeah. Because it was already a district that was not super, you know, partisan one way or the other before. Well, let's turn to our next issue, which I'm not going to spoil it because we're going to have a lead-in with one of Tim's outrages of the week. So, Tim, I'm going to let you go ahead with the outrage of the week, and then we will discuss it from there.
All right. I guess I should start it with an admission, guys. It won't be any surprise to you or anyone that knows me or listens to this show, but watching Fox News for any amount of time can be quite a chore for a guy like myself. I've always been convinced, and with very good reason, that they slant the news in order to appeal to a certain audience. And as recent legal cases have proved, they are also willing to defame others using outright lies from their hosts. There's no denying that. The offended business in question both sued and collected a large amount of money. So I swallowed hard this week and tuned in to the heavily promoted Great Red State, Blue State debate between Ron DeSantis and Gavin Newsom. And I'm going to admit right off the bat that it was a rating success with almost 5 million viewers. It was quite the coup for the network, along with host and moderator, if you want to call him that, Sean Hannity. Now, what I witnessed, predictably, was an outright mess. I saw a moderator, Hannity, clearly taking sides, no surprise, peppering Newsom with questions designed to make him and the state of California look bad while feeding softball questions to Governor DeSantis. Now, it really didn't seem to help DeSantis that much, as Newsom was hammering him, ridiculing him, and totally outfoxing him at every turn. Really, what I saw is a debate that was supposed to be a debate between Newsom and DeSantis turned first into a Newsom versus DeSantis versus Hannity affair, and ending up as a match between Newsom and Hannity with DeSantis on the sidelines kind of contributing little of substance and smirking that famous lovely smirk of his. There are a lot of people out there who think this debate was important. Many pundits breathlessly heralded it as the debate that American voters should have gotten, as opposed to the real debate next year between President Biden and Donald Trump. Me, I think that is absolutely absurd. This was nothing more to me than an interesting sideshow, a creation of a so-called news network in search of ratings, and the moderator had his own agenda to use half-truths, cherry-pick data, and outright falsehoods to attempt to make a Democrat look bad and a failing Republican candidate who really needed the help to look good. So, John Hannity had something to gain. Ron DeSantis had something to gain, and Fox News had something to gain. I'm not going to judge Gavin Newsom for even participating in this farce. I guess he did what he thought he needed to do. But I would strongly caution and remind elected officials who agree to appear on Fox News that they should see things for what they are, because the outrage that any of you who watched it saw the other night is what you're going to get in any debate or back and forth that they choose to engage in on that network with any of our elected officials. And you know what? They don't even try to hide it, David.
No, I think you're absolutely right about it. It ended up being kind of a Newsom versus Sean Hannity debate first and foremost, which was by no means a net positive for Ron DeSantis, who was trying to raise his profile, who has the most current electoral skin in the game. Now, Catherine, I know you're probably a regular watcher of Sean Hannity. You probably subscribe to the exclusive extra content. So give us your thoughts on that Fox endeavor.
Well, I watched the excerpts of it. I couldn't watch an hour of Sean Hannity.
A wise decision.
as usual, you know, Gavin Newsom was poised and articulate, and, you know, he's very good looking, and he carries that role very well. He was on point. The excerpts I saw, he didn't really get nervous or, you know, stutter or anything. He was very composed. DeSantis is just an idiot, and Hannity too. And I think this hurt DeSantis because of the insertion of Sean Hannity into the debate. It made DeSantis look weak and not very well informed. And I thought it made, I mean, it doesn't really matter how Newsom came off, because the people who are watching it don't care about Gavin Newsom except to find more ways to criticize him for some reason. So I think the net is that journalism took a hit. Because it's not journalism, but people think it is. And Gavin Newsom probably raised his Q score, whatever they call it these days, a bit, just because, and because he was willing to do it, and he didn't, you know, fall on the floor. He didn't like use bad language. He didn't lose his temper. And I think, I don't know. I guess I sort of feel like it was good for Gavin Newsom to do that. I'm always I go back and forth whether we should engage them or not. But occasionally I think it's good for us to get up in their faces and show them that sometimes that we do have good ideas and we are capable. Not very often,
yeah. But
from time to time.
Yeah, I think that is the trick. It's like there's so many people that just default to that news source. I'm not even sure they're total right-wingers. It's just what plays in whatever cafe. I mean, there's a good chunk of rural America that just thinks that's, the modern-day Walter Cronkite. And is, misguided as that may be, you have to work within that parameter. And I think Gavin Newsom really did a good job. It was like he walked into the lion's den and fought the lion's and he fought the lion tamer.
Well,
I'm being generous calling DeSantis a lion by any means, because DeSantis, I don't know if I showed you that clip of him smirking when trying to smile when Newsom was talking, but he is just, my goodness, his facials are terrible. I've never seen anything like it. Tim, what you got?
Well, I was going to ask you, politically, what do you think Newsom's angle was here?
Well, I had heard this a while back. When Gavin Newsom, remember, he had the recall election put him up against him, as misguided as it was, it only got like 38%. It got just the base Republican vote. He realized that there was this whole, news or this whole set of talking points out there that he and most Democrats weren't familiar with. And so he started watching more Fox News, trying to go on Fox News more, knowing that in his state there may be 38-40% of Californians that are more to that angle. If that's the case in California, extrapolate it out to the country, and it's closer to 50%. And so I think that's where his impetus was to try to get in there. Obviously, this raises his profile. I'll say this, too. Now, when we compare this, our debates have just really suffered since 2016 because Donald Trump just ruins any debate, whether it's a GOP primary debate or it's a federal debate where he's debating another Democrat. I mean, have we ever had a civilized debate that included Donald Trump and is misguided and is off the target with a very biased moderator in Sean Hannity? That debate Wednesday night was far closer to what we had pre-16 than post-2016, in my opinion. What do you think, Catherine?
I think that's a pretty good point. I really do have to hand it to Newsom for being willing to do it. I was thinking about it after I watched the clip. I wonder if there was any suggestion or not pressure, but suggestion from Democratic leaders and not necessarily elected officials, but donors and advisors that someone do this and that Gavin Newsom was a good selection. I don't know if there's anything to that, but I wonder if that was done.
It would appear that the scuttlebutt is that Newsom and Hannity know each other pretty well, get along pretty well, and mutually came up with this idea.
That doesn't make me happy.
Yeah, Newsom was not recruited, I don't think, by Democrats to do it or pressured in any way to do it.
Okay.
He wanted to do it. And DeSantis stood there looking like he wished he wasn't doing it, to be honest with you, because when it came to facts and figures, he was just getting hammered, and he was the recipient of some really good zingers, like, when Newsom said There are two of us standing here, and one thing we have in common is that neither one of us is going to be
the
nominee
ballot
of our party for president. Oh, boy. And it was stuff like that the whole debate. It really was. He even jeered at him one time and said, look, Nikki Haley has laid you out. Why don't you just get out of the way? Oh, that made DeSantis mad. Oh, that made him mad.
Oh. Well, Tim, back to your earlier point, they may not be as good of friends or cordial in the future after some of those comments.
I don't know. I think Hannity enjoyed it, too, even though he
oh,
was.
Oh, you mean Hannity.
He
really
was.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, Hannity really was DeSantis didn't enjoy it at all. I think
no,
Hannity kind of did.
Yeah. No, and obviously Hannity at the end of the day, and the Fox News, they just want ratings. And in that ratings
yeah, but,
bump you talked about, Tim, how many of that was – some of that was Democrats and Fox News may say, huh, if
oh,
we're
yeah,
not completely in the tank for Republicans, we might could expand our audience.
Yeah, I certainly turned over there, and you did. So Catherine watched the
yeah,
highlights of it. And,
yeah.
You know, we normally don't do any of that.
Yeah, and so I just have to wonder what this will be like. I'm like, hey, maybe there is something there. And I also wonder, you know, Gavin Newsom early in the thing, and I have not gotten to watch the – I actually watched a ton of highlights, and I recorded it and watched – I think I'm about the halfway point. But early in the debate, Gavin Newsom – talked about how in the past 2 years, more Floridians have moved to California than the other way around. That's a stat I hadn't heard either.
And
I wonder
it turned
how
out to be
that,
true.
Yes,
it did turn out to be true.
Yeah, and so I wonder how many people on Fox are like, the regular viewers are like, wow, I never heard that. And they looked it up and go, huh, it actually is, you know, pretty close, but it's true. And, you know, of course, because that's the thing. So many times we have these answers we think, oh, well, it'll just fit on the bumper sticker, the solution, when things are far more complicated. Housing
yeah,
costs go up because a lot of people move somewhere. That's why Florida is now having housing costs much closer to California. And also they have the insurance issues. California,
oh, yeah,
I heard that some places 563% increase on home insurance. That's getting close to $1,000 on a decent sized home a month.
Yeah.
And so,
but you know, on the other hand, Florida has got the third highest number of poor people in the country. Now, you know what? Hannity didn't mention that. He didn't ask of. He didn't ask DeSantis about it. All the critical questions were directed at Newsom and about California, comparing, you know, like California is the worst place on earth. Florida is a virtual paradise. He would ask Kennedy one of these leading cherry-picked data questions about California and then turn to DeSantis and say, what do you think about that? Yeah, that's tough. And DeSantis still didn't do well with it.
Oh, yeah, it was basically like, let's compare the villages to Skid Row when you could
yeah,
compare Santa Monica or Malibu to some little, you know, very poor town in north central Florida. You know, I mean,
Florida,
you can always
I mean,
do that
California
kind of
California has a bigger economy than all but four countries on the face
right,
of the earth to compare. Yeah. Those two places or any place in this country to California economically is absolutely ludicrous. But they did.
Yeah, I thought it was just really interesting there. And it really was an interesting debate. When they talked about taxes and they were, you know, and I will say this one of the few things I actually thought Sean Hannity was truthful about. He said this is a difference about philosophies. And he actually kind of said, you know, like, it was a little more helpful to what Newsom was making his point than a lot of other things he did. And, of course, the graphics department did a hit job on Newsom, but yet Newsom still debated back from it because every graphic that they put the question was just the worst framing for whatever Democrats
did
believe
you
in.
See,
but, you know, made the case about taxes It's just a different way to tax. It's not higher. It's
Did you
different.
See DeSantis pull the paper, scrap of paper out of his pocket and hold it up, and the brown smudges were supposed to be poop from one of the major California cities representing poop on the street. And even Newsom got a kick out of that. He just kind of grinned at the, you know, oh, come
on. And apparently, according to Tegan Goddard, that was against the rules, and the First Lady of California took quite umbrage to that, although the First Lady of Florida was not happy with the debate either. Apparently, the First Ladies were having far less fun than the governor of California, certainly, and probably even the governor of Florida. Let's get into some of the political questions about this. So Ron DeSantis is actually running for president and participates in debates with Vivek Ramaswamy, with Nikki Haley, with Tim Scott up until recently. They're dropping out so fast, I can't even keep up. I think Mike Pence has dropped out. We're down to just a few candidates, but he's having to debate them. He's had practice. What if a Fox Republican viewer watched this and they're going to pick up a ballot in January, March, April, February and vote in the Republican primaries? What do you think this did to Ron DeSantis' choices there, Catherine?
I don't think it helped him. I think he looked like an idiot. You know, he wasn't. I shouldn't say that, but he wasn't prepared. He wasn't articulate. He didn't have the necessary data and numbers to adequately present what he was trying to argue. And Newsom had all that and more. And so he looked. He looked weak, and he did not look at all presidential, not at all. Not that Trump does either, but whatever.
Tim, same question. What do you think the takeaway, or what do you think people are going to think about Ron DeSantis after this debate, given that he's had a lot more chances on national stage recently than Gavin Newsom?
The people have seen him and seen him and seen him and seen him, and they've already made their decision on him, and I'm pretty sure their decisions are hardened. Donald Trump is so far ahead. DeSantis is in danger of dropping into fourth place. Nikki Haley is surging right past him, and Ramaswamy has even caught him. And, you know, I guess it's an act of desperation on his part to go on Fox News with this and try to rescue his campaign. I tell you, David, he either wins Iowa or he's gone. Right then. He has to win Iowa. He has sunk all kind of money, recruited all kind of volunteers, practically lived up there. And he's still over 30 points behind in the polls. He has to win Iowa or he's done, because Trump's going to win New Hampshire the next week. And when it turns south, Trump is really going to turn it up. That's what he's down to, David. He just better move to Des Moines or one of those towns and live there. And this Fox News debate ain't going to help at all. That's it.
Yeah, I think it hurt him too. He was already on life support this campaign.
Yeah,
and it got him attention, but it got him such bad attention in the end. I mean, even with Sean Hannity and the graphics department at Fox doing all their work on his behalf, he still couldn't close the deal. Didn't even seem close. I mean, the highlights, I will say, when you actually watch the debate, it seems closer in real time than the highlights, because I mean, granted, the cut-ups I'm seeing are from more Democratic sources, but it's still, you know, anybody that's being objective is going to, you know, say that Newsom did the better job. And he theoretically had so much less to lose. Now, let's talk about Gavin Newsom. It is, I think, most political observers' belief that Joe Biden's going to be the 2024 nominee.
And therefore, Gavin Newsom is term limited. He will leave office in 2026. So the time doesn't really fit really well, although I guess he could, you know, not have been encumbered with the governor's office for 2 years. But then also I guess there is this chance, everybody thinks, that the thing could open up at the last minute. Catherine, what did Gavin Newsom gain out of this debate?
Well, I don't think he's going to be on the ticket in 2024. It would have to be something really dramatic for him to be on that ticket. But I think that that timing is perfect for 2028. He's finished as governor. He spends 2 years running for president. I think that's perfect timing. It allows him to be running for president and not being governor at the same time, which I think is a good thing. So this is, I think, like an opportunity for him to just get some face time, up his Q score, let everyone get to know him, and so that he's brave and willing to debate the opposite side and hold up well in that debate.
Yes. Well, let's put a pin in that real quickly. Our guest, Doug Kaplan, is on the line. Doug, I want to welcome you back into the Kudzu Vine.
Hey, how you been? Thank you for having me.
Yes, glad to have you on the show tonight. Well, Doug, we know that you've done polling for quite a long time. You're still doing polling with your new firm, Kaplan Strategies. But I don't actually want to ask about any of the exact numbers. I'm going to let Tim and Catherine get into some of that. I'm just going to ask about polling in general. Polling has had
right.
some rough patches and less rough patches, and it seems to be a lot of more MAGA-type voters that have just entered the Republican electorate really not trusting polling, and then therefore pollsters had to overcorrect for that. What are you seeing when you get ready to conduct a poll? What do you do to try to turn the dials to get a more accurate sample?
Well, some of the methods have changed in polling. Texting has become a big part of polling, where you'll text to a person and then it'll go to a web page. And it's only been around really for one or two elections. And it's a big part of polling because it's cheaper than the other methods. So it's not 100% where they know the results on it. You would think you would get similar results to a live phone call. But you're using voter lists. You know, you just have to – it's just tougher and tougher.
So do you think the text option you're mentioning, is that making the polls more accurate, or is it just another method and it's just something you have to do because of technology?
I would say it makes it more accurate. Depending on the mode that you're using, I think it could be better than internet or automated phone calls, because you're reaching cell phone users, you're reaching everybody randomly.
Yes. Well, I'm going to go ahead and pass it to Tim, who has some more questions about some of your recent polls, and then he'll pass it to Catherine. Tim?
Oh, good evening, Mr. Kaplan. Thank you for being with us again. I kind of want to stick with the national stuff because you've done some national polling in recent months, especially on the Republican race. And a guy that has really intrigued me is Vivek Ramaswamy. Why do you think he has performed as well as he has, including in your poll, and what type of voter do you think supports him?
You know, his day definitely came. He was at about 10 to 14% in July. He's lost a significant portion of that because of media scrutiny.
Uh-huh.
But I think you know, the Trump voter who doesn't want to vote for him, but who's definitely considers himself MAGA.
Uh-huh. Now, you're in Florida, and as well as Governor DeSantis has done electorally Florida, and he's done as well as any statewide politician down there in my memory. Why did that not translate into national success?
Well, you know, he performed just as good as the Attorney General, Ashley Moody, and the CEO, Jimmy Patronis, the statewide office. And none of them are running for president.
Yeah.
His first election was against Andrew Gilliam, a gentleman under federal investigation for fraud, which was well-known public, a terrible candidate. And he only won that election by a half a point. Some say he's got some stuff done in Florida. I'll leave that, you know, to others. But he's had super majorities, so it's a lot easier to govern when you have a rubber stamp versus dealing with the Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. And part of your last question is, I think, you know, early states are retail politics, and the more the people see him, you know, it seems like they like Trump. He's winning by a significant amount, but then they like Nikki Haley better, it seems, you know, and all the polling show right now she's number two with less money and organization and no big backers.
So, right before you came on the air, we were talking about him, and I made the statement that I believe that either he has to win in Iowa or he's done right then. Would you agree with that?
Well, New Hampshire is not DeSantis country, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So he has to either win or come awfully close to Trump. He's putting a lot of time. He's got the attorney. He's got the governor, Kim Reynolds. He got the Bob Vandeplatz, who's very influential there with the evangelicals, and it hasn't helped him a bit. He's third now, Nikki Haley, in some polls, so he's in deep trouble. Even if he finishes second, it looks like it'll be very, you know, by 20 or 30 points to Trump. Then he goes to New Hampshire, and he's just going to have a horrible time there. He's going to finish no better than third in South Carolina. So where is his path? How does he come back?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got it there. One more question about national politics, and then I'm going to send it over to Catherine for some more questions. And I want to ask you about Florida. I believe that Florida is probably off the national map for national Democrats in 2024. Am I right about that?
Something significantly happened in Florida, and it'll be interesting when all the studies come out. We've seen Democrats used to lead in registration. Now the Republicans have a pretty good lead in the amount of Republicans versus Democrats. Yet there are a lot of independents that are movable. And again, Andrew Gilliam only won the election by a half a point in 2018, and Rick Scott only won by 1% in 2018. So it's not completely off the table. It's similar to North Carolina. The problem is there's no state level, there's no candidates that are in you know, state house and state senate that are coming up that they can count on. They pretty much lost the machine they had. They lost Stephanie Murphy. They lost Val Demings last time. So the whole organization is pretty weak in Florida. But I can't imagine that it's off the table forever. I think one other thing that's happened is you've all these people that have moved here, but you know, for every person, let's say it's from Puerto Rico that's moved here, you've got a guy from the Midwest that was conservative that's boots here. It's just Sarasota. And in the last election, the Hispanic vote was significantly for the Republicans, significantly. So I don't know if it's an anomaly or what, but something definitely changed. But I'm not convinced it's a red state. It's the purple state that leans red. They just won the governor's race, the Democrats, in Jacksonville. It's an important thing to point out, which is a more conservative place to begin with, and the Democrats were able to claim that seat.
Well, that does give us some hope, and I thank you for all of that, sir, and I'm going to send it over to Catherine now. Catherine?
Hey, thank you for being on tonight, Mr. Kaplan. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to ask you. I may be asking you a question that is outside of your area, but let's just try it. Imagine it's 2028 and about the same time. Where are we? How will polls change? Do you think we'll have all the AI and all that stuff will have any impact on it? Are we going to see any dramatic changes in how we – are we going to see much more texting, more maybe secure Internet polls or – I mean, how do we think we might – what changes might we see that might improve the overall performance of polls? Because I think we've all been we all still smart from some of the polls – from over the past couple of cycles?
Well, you know, the polls, if you look at a single poll, there could be some disappointment, but if you just look at the averages of Real Clear Politics, they weren't off in 2022. In 2020, they were spot on. And 2016, they were pretty accurate. The problem was no one predicted that he would win the Electoral College and lose the popular vote, which someone should have come up with, since Bush pulled that off in 2000.
right.
But I don't know. AI is going to change things in ways that we don't know yet.
Okay. And are you – so the way I always think of polls is it's like the poll that I read today is – from that moment, whatever right. that moment was, whether it was 3 days ago and they talked to, 1,500 voters, it was that moment, and it's probably pretty accurate, but it was really only for that moment. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, it doesn't predict the future, it just predicts the moment. And about 5 to 10% of polls are just completely off. It's just, it happens statistically. There's confidence levels and margin of errors.
Maybe what we need to do is give the less to take the polls as what they really are instead of looking at them as predictors. And I'm sure that pollsters like you do that, but I think sometimes the media and other people. I have a brother who lives in Brazil, and he's constantly, I talk to him every week, and every week he's got, oh, did you see that poll on Biden? I'm like, well, that was one poll, or maybe it was three polls. But, I mean, he's just an ordinary American expatriate living in Brazil. He's not a politician or a, anything. I mean, he's exceptional to me, but so I just wonder if maybe we need to, instead of anticipating how polls might change, try to persuade people. Because sometimes I think that these polls help, people make decisions about around them. They're like, oh, well, he's polling really low. I better not vote. I don't want to vote for a loser, even if it's the candidate that you think is most appropriate. This is especially in the primary. But so maybe we need to work on how polls are received as much as how they're taken.
Yeah, I would agree. It depends how, depends how the media reports it. They find a poll that might agree with their narrative, so they go with it, and then they forget about the other polls that are out there. The important thing is no poll is going to be exact and predict, exactly what the numbers are. It's going to be 2 to 3 points always off as a margin of error in every single poll. So there's always going to be off 2 to 3 points. And the last few elections, the swing states, the six states, or five or six states, they've been decided by the tens of thousands or less. It's impossible to predict that or poll that. How do you know? I mean, the races are swinging. There's so many variables of why the race is swinging, and it's such few votes, that it could go either way. And it's within the margin of error. So it's impossible to accurately predict the polling if the race is decided by 10,000 because it's within the margin of error either way.
I think there's a lot of people who actually know the exact number in Georgia because Donald Trump tried to demand those 11,000, 830 votes or whatever it was. So
okay.
That's not very many votes in a state as big as Georgia in a national election. So I just think we have a lot to learn about it. And pardon?
No, I was just going to say, it's probably, 50-50 country, or maybe Democrats have about a 2-point advantage.
Yeah, that's what I've always thought. That's what I've always felt, like a bit of an advantage for Democrats, but not if you look at the maps, though. Anyway, thank you so much for your insight and for all the work that you do. We really appreciate having you on the show. Thanks so much. I'm going to send it back to David.
Yes. Doug, before you leave us and our listeners, tell our listeners where they might can read some of your polls and see about your work during the day and what have you. Right. Doug, did you you going to leave our listeners with some thoughts on how they can read your work? Doug, are you there with us? Tim and Catherine, can you hear me okay?
We hear you fine.
Okay. Well, Doug's showing us on the line. I was going to let him tell us about his services, and I didn't know. I was making sure I didn't do something funny with the phone after I wasn't asking questions. We just want to thank Doug Kaplan for coming to the show tonight and sharing about polling with us. But we've just got about 10 more minutes, and in that time, let's get to our next topic. And we're probably going to end up talking about this topic a few more weeks because it's going to unfold and these things could even change. But the legislative session started, and at the start of the session, or actually ahead of the session, they released a set of Senate maps, the Republicans did, then a set of House maps. The Democrats released a set of Senate maps. And then just on a late Thursday, the congressional maps came out. So we got three new sets of maps. Pretty much the big changes were all in Metro Atlanta, except for the Democratic maps. The one I saw, I guess it was actually, a state house map. It had a change in the Dalton area, which I thought was really interesting. But these maps came out. The Republicans, they stayed to the part where it has to do with, you got to create more African-American districts, but then it manipulated a lot of other districts. Not sure really they even did that on the U.S. House maps. The congressional maps, I believe, are the most controversial of the three. Tim, what are your thoughts on the three maps?
Well, I mean, let's dwell on the Republican maps because I'm sure those are the ones that are going to carry the day. And in the state house, the Democrats would gain two seats and bring it to, 99 to 81, I believe. There would be five majority black districts created, as was mandated. The GOP really got creative with the state Senate maps. They added two majority black districts, but they managed somehow to keep the 33-23 split as it is by carving up some other districts, combining some, and a couple of Democrats would lose their jobs to create these two new what would be Democratic districts. Now, the proposal for the House that you mentioned, it would create a new majority black district, but here they go after Lucy McBath again. It would just pretty much rip her current district to shreds and her new district if she chose to represent it, and I'm sure she would since she lives in Cobb County, I believe. her new district would be in parts of Cobb, Douglas, Fulton, and Fayette. This is the second time, you know, they've targeted her, and it would also pretty much keep things as they are, and the maps have so far been approved strictly on party line votes, and I imagine some of this, David's going to wind up back in court, but probably not in time, I don't think, to affect the 2024 elections. They'll have to use these maps, I guess, at least for that election that they pass now. What do you think?
Yeah,
Catherine?
Catherine, go ahead.
I mean, I don't understand why these people can't be honest and forthcoming about this. It's not, I mean, I know it's complicated to do all this, but it's pretty simple to not mess with everything. Like, just do what the court told you to do and don't do anything else. Like, just do that and let's move on. But they can't do it that way. And to be fair, I don't think we did it that way before, so, which is what they always say to us. So, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I will say this. I mean, Tim's right. The big loser in all this is mostly Lucy McBath. Interestingly, I saw a map that had where the House members of the current district that are in the Metro Atlanta area are, and the districts, and there's actually going to be two districts, the one that wraps around Cobb County, Douglas, South Fulton, and DeFayette. That one has no incumbent that actually lives there. And then there's another district that goes through Rockdale and Henry and Clayton and may even include a portion of DeKalb as well. It has no incumbent because Hank Johnson lives in the other DeKalb district. David Scott and Nakima Williams both live in the same, I guess, the new fifth district as well. So it's going to be interesting to see where they run. I will say this. I was talking to some people and was very curious about this. You know, in the past times they've gone after Sanford Bishop, while they have to keep his district majority-minority, it has to, but they've worked around with it a bit to where it was tougher for him. Actually, I think it looked like in this map they gave up on that. They're like, we're not going to beat Sanford Bishop. And his district got a little more Democratic. Which for him, that's good news. That's just one place folks aren't going to have to focus on, although it does give a race outside of Metro Atlanta that people can focus on to kind of get out the vote. So I guess it has a plus and a minus each way. Had y'all noticed that about Sanford Bishop's district?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And another thing I wanted to mention go ahead, Tim.
I was just going to say, I think they're just going to be patient and wait there. A lot of them are thinking, I believe, that this is Sanford Bishop, the person who is keeping that seat in the Democratic column. And when in the future it becomes open, it might be something of a different ballgame. They might be right about that.
Yeah, but then aren't Democrats in rural areas, of really all over the country, aren't they in a nadir? I mean, there's nowhere to go but up. And you can get prepared
for that.
Or just stay down.
Don't forget that.
But, yeah. But, I mean, it gets a little bit better. And also you have time to groom someone. Because Sanford Bishop, I stood in line with him a little under a year ago, and he seems to be in really good health considering his age and all. I don't think he's going anywhere anytime soon. Let me mention one last thing before we wrap up the show. The state house map, it seems to put a lot of incumbents together, not only Democrats but also Republicans. And if I'm not mistaken, Democrats, even under the Republican map, gain 3 to 4 seats, depending on how you look at Misha Maynard's district, which is one of the most Democratic ones in the state, even though she switched parties to become a Republican.
I'm going to stick with two.
So you don't think
there's
going to be that many?
I'm going to stick with two, yeah.
It may be two, and then her district makes three. You know, so that
that'll be interesting to watch. But, I mean, the Republicans basically could not figure out a way to hold the same majority in the House, which shows that we're just getting to be too big to round up, which is a good thing.
Right.
You know, growing the power. Well, thanks again for Doug Kaplan of Kaplan Strategies coming on the show. Next week we've got Alex Diaz coming on the show. He'll talk to us about Nevada politics, but also Alex has been covering the Mexican elections, which are really interesting because even though it's still a little ways off, it has two nominees for the major parties that are both female, and Mexico is by default, unless something just dramatically unexpected happen, will elect its first female president. So we're going to talk to Alex about both political, entities next week. But until then, for the Cudzivine,
good night, guys.